Welcome to episode 17 of the We'll Bring the Popcorn Entertainment Podcast. I'm Brad, this is Josh, and on today's episode, we are breaking down episode 7 of X-Men 97.
Yes.
The series finale of Shogun. And our film review of Boy Kills World.
Yeah, looking forward to that as well. But once again, we want to start off this week's episode with the unfortunate passing of Ray Chan, who a lot of people don't know who Ray Chan is, but Ray Chan was most recently the production designer for the Deadpool and Wolverine movie. But he's a longtime like supervising art director for Marvel Studios. So he's been involved in countless number of Marvel projects over the years. So we just wanted to pay respects to the man who worked, one of the many people who worked tirelessly putting those films together, and just wanted to pay respects. So condolences to him and his family.
Yeah, because some of the big set designs and things from the MCU with, you know, Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum, sure. And there's several other things that he handled. Yeah. Like, really sad to hear that he passed. We don't really have more information on him or his age or anything else. But yeah, we just wanted to offer our condolences to his family and friends. And absolutely. I know Ryan Reynolds put out a big post about mm-hmm. him, and it's just sad to see more people.
Yeah, for sure. Away. I mean, like, we talk a lot about when actors pass and the impacts they have because they're in front of the camera, but there's so many more unsung heroes that go into making these films that, you know, he had such a big part in creating so many of the iconic visual things that you see in these Marvel films that, you know, we especially wanted to make sure that he got his flowers as well.
Yep. Moving on to our news this week. So we've talked about 28 Years Later quite a bit. Now we have some really big casting news for it because we've got Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Jodie Comer, and Ralph Fiennes have all joined the cast of, I mean, that's three big actors joining the cast of 28 Years Later. So it just got me even more pumped for, you know, that new trilogy to begin.
Yeah, it's exciting because, you know, Aaron Taylor-Johnson's getting a lot of publicity right now, especially with, you know, I know they've had the playful banter about whether or not he's going to perform as James Bond upcoming. He's one of the top picks for that if he hasn't been confirmed for it already. I know there was the little fun of he's getting a little tired of people asking about it because I think he turned it on one of the people that asked him the question and said, are you getting tired of being asked about James Bond? He's like, well, are you tired of asking the question yet? Like, it was kind of funny. But
yeah, because the reporter's like, no, and he's like,
fair enough.
Just walked away like, okay.
But no, it's exciting because that's a nice pull for this film. You know, a lot of times, you know, you make horror films and there aren't a lot of big name actors that are willing to jump into those type of projects. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they pulled three like this that have, you know, the credentials that they have is pretty impressive. And like you said, it's got me super excited for this film too.
Yeah, and you add, you know, potentially that Cillian Murphy is going to come back to be an on-screen presence past being executive producer. I mean, those four already give you a rather stacked cast, and it's going to be really fun to watch.
Yeah, it's going to load up nicely. I'm looking forward to them finally getting this shot made and put out because you and I are both big fans of the film as well, and the fact that they're continuing it and getting the cast that they're getting for this has me really excited for the potential of what they plan to do with this, for sure. So moving on to another property, Sony has come out and said they've signed a deal to make movies and TV shows based on the Clue board game. Now we have, you know, the film that was made in, I want to say, the late 80s, early 90s, adaptation with like Tim Curry and Susan Sarandon that were in it, but it seems like they're going to move forward with a modern day take on it that could spin off into potentially multiple properties out of it.
Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and say we're taking credit for this because, you know, we talked when Margot Robbie was announced to be doing Monopoly, and we talked about, you know, how easy Clue seems to be to adapt that board game into it that they did with Tim Curry. Next time up, you know, Sony's announcing that they're revisiting Clue with new TV shows and movies, so you know, you're welcome, everyone. But seriously, it's that one seems like a really kind of easy home run to do as something, whether series or film, because it is a murder mystery board game. So like that would be kind of the easiest out of all these board games to adapt.
You would think, and there's obviously no like information beyond the fact that they're doing it at this point. So let the dream casting of this type of thing go into play here. Like, are they going to skew towards a younger cast? Is it going to be an older cast? Is it going to be a mix of both? There's so many endless possibilities of people you can see playing each character. So it's going to be exciting to see how it, you know, how much more news comes out of it moving forward, who's going to be attached to it, because there could be potential to have some really fun things come out of it for sure.
Yeah, because same thing, we don't know. Could they go a more serious route with them and, you know, to appeal to the deeper
sure.
murder mystery fans and stuff with that. Like we had the Orient Express and all those murder mysteries mm-hmm. that we've had lately. You know, are you going to try to appeal more to that crowd, or are you going to keep it more lighthearted and fun? Kind of like the original sure. adaptation of Clue was with Tim Curry. That was more a little bit goofy and lighthearted and fun with it. So there's a few different directions to even go with the tone Absolutely. And how they approach it. But being a board game adaptation, I would figure that they're probably still going to try to keep it family friendly-ish.
Maybe, yeah.
And probably PG-13, PG, probably not PG, but probably PG-13 range. But it'll be interesting to see and kind of their approach to a more modern day. Like, is it going to be a modern day setting? Are they going to go with a, you know, classic time period to do, you know, Clue with and well? So there's a lot they can play with this, especially if they're doing shows and TV where they be connected.
Sure.
To, you know, we're in that time of DC and MCU yeah. and everything else. Is everything going to be connected, or are they purposely going to do maybe the movies would be more for the adult murder mystery fans and the shows would be more maybe for the family yeah. or something. So we'll keep an eye on it and see exactly where they go with Clue.
Yeah, gonna be fun to keep an eye on that one.
Another property that it seemed like Netflix was looking to revisit was A Knight's Tale. So this is a guilty pleasure movie for me. Heath Ledger was fantastic in it. He Absolutely. Had a great cast behind it. A fun, silly, you know, medieval movie. Well, they were looking to do a sequel for it, yeah. but apparently they used an algorithm to tell them if it was going to be successful or not, and the algorithm said no. So they passed on it, which... That's kind of weird to me because, I mean, there could be a lot of properties you miss out on just because an algorithm says it's not like Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Sure.
Wild, crazy, over-the-top, insane movie that I absolutely loved. I have a feeling an algorithm would tell them that that movie wasn't going to be very successful, like Hot Dog Fingers and all that. Is that going to be a successful movie?
Right.
But at the same time, is this a property that needed to be revisited, especially with Heath Ledger no longer being here?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to do a continuation of the story without him, I guess it would be fine. But I don't like the whole an algorithm telling you whether a property is going to be successful mm-hmm. because you just never know. Like it's one of those things that it makes no sense to me. It sounds kind of like a cop out. Now, if you want to just own up and say, hey, we weren't creatively like finding something that worked for us or fit for us, I could see that being a reason. And we've talked about that before, especially mm-hmm. with, you know, talking about Quentin Tarantino, like scrapping one of the ideas he had for his last film because it wasn't creatively where we wanted to be. That's more than fine. But to say that you just don't want to make a movie because, you know, a computer-generated algorithm tells you that it's not going to be successful. How many movies would you be missing out on if you did? If you did, you know, your decision making that way. Netflix is really weird about like why they do or don't do certain things, and that's mm-hmm. just another case of, you know, why are we scrapping projects like this for reasons like that? That makes no sense mm-hmm. to me.
Because we did get a little information on a story point that they were looking at with yeah. it. So it would have followed William Thatcher's daughter. So William Thatcher was Heath Ledger's mm-hmm. character. It would have followed his daughter wanting to kind of follow in his footsteps.
Sure.
To joust, to do all the knight stuff. But of course, women are not allowed to be that. So sure. it would have gotten her trying to get the gang back together to have them help her fulfill her dream and what she wanted to do, which that sound like it. I mean, you're revisiting a lot of what they did in the first, but if it's done right, it could have been fun. But then again, hearing their premise and everything else, maybe it is good that they leave some of this Heath Ledger stuff alone.
Well, yeah, I mean, when Heath Ledger's passing was, you know, obviously tragic, but it had such an impact on everybody that was, you know, making the films with them. I know it definitely helped boost the appeal of The Dark Knight when it came out for mm-hmm. sure, because, you know, that whole thing. And like you said, the premise that you're putting out there, it sounds potentially hit or fail, but have that be the reason why you don't mm-hmm. make it. Like, it's just like, okay, we can go this direction, but we're not confident in the story that we're able to tell. Just say that, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, it's okay to, you know, pivot from things that you don't feel is creatively what you want it to be, but don't sit there and say that it's an algorithm.
Like, no, the algorithm didn't like it.
Okay, if we're making decisions based on the algorithm, it's going to be nothing but, you know, Star Wars and Marvel films till the end of time, because those are the ones that print money, and here comes Harry Potter making another $1 billion. But, like, mm-hmm. like no, that, I feel some, I'm going to feel some type of way about that story in particular, because that just rubs me the wrong way that you're letting an algorithm make decisions for you now. Like, that's terrible.
Yeah, and with this information out now, well, and bring up anybody trying to maybe move ahead with it outside of the algorithm. May they get another studio, or because I don't know if Netflix, you know, has the rights, or they were just approached to do it.
Sure.
Or, you know, they'll try to do this somewhere else, but
you never know.
If they do, I hope they do it right and well. You've got to get everybody back because, you know, that cast was fantastic and did a lot of stuff. But it's also been quite a long time since they did it as well. So it may not have the same impact that the original had.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, it's a story we can keep an eye on to see if it does move anywhere away from Netflix. If they're really wanting to get the movie made, hopefully they find a studio willing to back them and put it out. That's, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we want, right? If they're that confident in the story that they want to tell, hopefully they get with the right people that can put the effort behind it to make it what they want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we can kind of leave it at that, I think, because I could talk about algorithms and how I feel about that all day, but we won't bog down the show with that for sure. Mm-hmm. Moving on to speaking of Marvel, Tom Holland has come out in an interview this week and said that, you know, him playing the character of Spider-Man has changed his life so much. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, he's always going to be down to do more, which is kind of a little bit of a pivot from some of the things he said previously, where he wanted to, he never necessarily said he would never do it again, but he kind of wanted to step away. And he has done that. Like, he hasn't, you know, he's gone and made Uncharted, and he's done, you know, theater and done a few other things. So he stepped away and, like, kind of scratched a little bit more of that different creative itch for himself, but it seems like it's something that he's kind of come out and confirmed that he's willing to come back to. So there's definitely some more Spider-Man stuff coming out, but there was some stuff to add to that for sure.
Yeah, and he revealed along with that he's actually part of the creative process of the script writing and creating the story for Spider-Man 4, which it's nice to see that he can have his input. It's a character that he's put a lot into and has helped shaped. And, you know, where we left the character at No Way Home, there's many different directions that could go with it.
Absolutely.
And we know, and we've reported on the past, that Sony and Marvel have kind of butted heads a little bit because Sony wants something a little bit different than Marvel, because I think Marvel wants to keep it, you know, a more grounded street level that, you know, could expand a lot more with, you know, like our favorite Daredevil and Punisher and other things like that. But, you know, Sony wants to kind of keep it a bigger multiverse type of story. So it's going to be curious to see how they come to an agreement here, which also, you know, we had with Euphoria's next season.
Yeah.
They talked about it was going to be delayed because of her shooting Spider-Man 4 this fall. Well, the way kind of Tom talked about it was that they're not quite done with it yet, and they're not going to do it until they feel right about it. Like, if we don't have the story right, we're not starting it. So that fall filming for Spider-Man 4 may kind of be in jeopardy.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we've talked about it numerous times here. Like, if it's not where you want it to be, you don't have to, you know, shoot it within a particular, you might get a little pushback from the studio, maybe, that they're like, hey, we want this sooner rather than later. But I'm glad that they're kind of, you know, putting their foot down and saying, no, it's not where we want it to be yet. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll make it when it's right, because it goes without saying that anytime you put this Spider-Man movie out, it's going to make a ton of money. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a huge hit. I mean, all three of Tom Holland's Spider-Man films have all grossed over $1 billion, if I'm not mistaken. So trust me, it's not going to be a lack of interest whenever they finally make this. And there's a lot of hype surrounding the follow-up to this because of, like you said, what happened with the end of No Way Home and, you know, everything that transpired in that film and then where they go next. Obviously, people are invested and are going to, you know, show up in droves, ourselves included, multiple times to see this film when it does get made. But no, it's good that he, you know, has kind of come out and said that, you know, I'll always come back to this, because you see a lot of waffling from some of the other people who have left these projects that are like, I'll never do it again. And then we report, you know, 2 years later that they've had a change of heart, because it's kind of unfair to ask these guys, like, as they're finishing this movie and as they're promoting it, that, you know, are probably a little burnt out to a point and just want to, you know, go do other things that interest them as well. And, you know, when the time's right, they'll come back to it. I kind of wish they would take a little bit more of an approach to that when talking about it, because it's easy to say, you know, it'll never happen. And then how do you look, 2 years later when you come back and say, oh, I'm ready to come back. Let's do it.
You know? Yeah, you got to look at, like, No Way Home, about the just amount of time it takes to film these superhero films.
Yeah, and it's a lot.
The physical toll it takes, too, because of the, you know, Tom Holland does a lot of his own stunts that, because he's still young and very physical and able to do the leaps and flips and, you know, everything else, that it's going to take a toll on you mentally and physically just because of how long and just how much you put your body. And, you know, that was an emotional film for, you know, his character and for Peter and everything through it. So, yeah, at the end of that, he's probably thinking, yeah, I'm ready to be done for a little bit with it. And you know, with a lot of things, you give yourself a little bit of time to sit and reflect and kind of process everything you went through. And now it's like, yeah, I'm ready to come back and then ready to do it.
That's not even a consideration. Like you say, like the stunts and stuff, but the things they have to do to get themselves in the physical shape to look like a superhero for a lot of these guys, that you hear about all the stuff that these guys have to go through, like diet wise and exercise wise and, you know, weightlifting regimens. Like it's insane what they put their bodies through to look you know, as good as they do in these films. So.
Yeah, because it was like with Hugh Jackman, how he talked about, you know, when he hung up Wolverine, it was like, that's a lot, you know, at his age, he's, what, 55 now, that he has to put his body through to get as ripped and his shape, and it's not as easy as his age, but that's a lot of time to working out, diet, everything that he has to do to get prepared for it. So it's like, even before they film, there's so much he has to put himself through just to get ready for it.
And I imagine that takes its toll over time, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, if we could all make superhero movies looking like Dude Thor, that would be great. You know, but you know they unfortunately don't get that luxury. But no, it's nice that he's come out and confirmed it, because we're all very much looking forward to, even if that fourth movie winds up being the final chapter that he does make for it. Like it's nice to hear that he's committed to it and wants to do it right and send it out the right way, if that's the direction they're willing to go.
Yep. Moving on with another Disney story here. So if you're a gamer, you kind of know the Kingdom Hearts. They've been out for a while. It's a big mix of Disney properties with original characters, and then you have Final Fantasy and Pixar, which, you know, it's Disney now, but it's still trying to keep them separate. They are, but they're are the same, but they're not.
Right.
And you've kind of got that big mixture through what? Three main games, but there's been some offshoot games as well. Yeah. They're looking at doing an adaptation of Kingdom Hearts. Well, they didn't say exactly if it's going to be a film, if it's going to be a TV series. We don't even know if it's going to be live action or animated. More likely it's going to be animated because it deals with Goofy and Donald and you know, Mickey and all those. More likely it's going to be animated, but this could be a lot of fun if it's done right, to appeal to a wide range of Disney fans, Pixar fans, video game fans, to do a full series or, you know, mini films. My only thing with it is the story throughout all the games has been confusing because, you know, it's a Japanese story that's very deep and layered and a whole lot of stuff going on, and it deals with clones and a lot of different things.
Oh,
I hope they're able to get a solid story that's just not as confusing as the games have been, to try to tell, like, who is that, but they're this of this of this of that. Like, what is going on in this story?
Yeah, those games are notorious for, like, odd dialogue and not really knowing, like, the full story and being able to follow it coherently, because you can go on YouTube and look up, you know, people have hours-long videos explaining the entire, trying to, you know, break down and explain the lore of these games, and the fact that they're willing to take it and put it into potentially a series or a movie, it's exciting, because I do love those games, and those are some of my favorite games to play, but taking all of that and trying to make it into, like, a property like that, it could be, like you said, the potential for it's a lot of fun. I really don't want it to be live action,
because
I don't want it to be, like, a mix of, you know, live action with animation, because that's so skews towards the side of not being good versus good.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that they can't do it, but I would love to see, like, a full-on animated, you know, Kingdom Hearts either series or movie, because it's at the end of the day, it's still fun. It's still a fun game, but taking it and putting it into that format, I'd be curious to see how they tell the whole story, because there's a lot to it. It almost has to be a series.
Yeah, because with the game series, you have to have played pretty much every game to understand it, because I've played the three mainline story games, but they have some offshoots that they did on, like, mobile and handheld back on the DS and stuff that I didn't really play those, but there was a lot of story stuff that they did in those games that when it came around to finally play 3 when it came out, like, these characters are from the handheld games or this story point. I didn't know what was going on, so I hope they're able to get a solid, understandable story when they do adapt this into whatever series or movie that they do with it.
Yeah, due to the popularity of the games, it's going to be a lot of people paying attention to what they do with it when it does come out. So that's definitely one to keep an eye on. We'll bring up more information to that as we find it. Keeping in the video game theme, though, we did get a little bit of interesting news in the gaming world this week when they announced that Cillian Murphy is potentially going to be playing the villain in the next Far Cry game. So if you've ever played the Far Cry games, how would you describe that to somebody? I'd have a hard way of describing it, like just thinking off the top of my head.
I mean, it's a very dark first-person shooter. Like, you're dealing with a lot of death, drugs, cartels, gangs. Like, it's dealing with some serious subject matter. So it's a big open-world game that allows you to choose, you know, which factions you're going to align yourself with to kind of go after the main big bad. And they've had really deep stories. Like, you had Giancarlo Esposito was the villain of Far Cry 6, and that was a very brutal villain in the way. Like, it was a very dark character. It was a fun game.
Very much.
Which I just finished a couple months ago. But, it's definitely a series for the older crowd. It's very violent. It doesn't really hold back from a lot of stuff. And to see Cillian Murphy be a part of it, like, I never really saw him being much of a gamer, because if you've seen some of his interviews and stuff, he doesn't really get on social media, doesn't really mess with technology too much. I didn't really see him as much of a gamer. To have him doing a voice in here, like, he's a fantastic actor. Absolutely. So see him play a villain in these games has got me excited for it.
It's fun, like you said, because I've seen those interviews. He does not give off gamer vibes at all, which would be absolutely hilarious if he were like secretly like a closeted super gamer and was just like, oh, I know all the ins and outs of it. Like, it would be so funny.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like his personality at all, but the fact that he's signing on to it, that actually has me excited for the next installment of the game, because it's got to be a good enough script for him to attach himself to something like that, because he doesn't just throw himself into things that he's not passionate about or interested in. So if they've approached him about this and he's interested in it, that gives me a lot of hope that, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun, because those are very fun games. And the fact that he's willing to put himself into it, I'm all for it.
Yeah, like you said, he's very selective of what he does. So if he's doing a video game, there's got to be a reason that gave him like, hey, I really like what this is doing. Let's go. But yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on that to see. So it hasn't been fully confirmed yet. It's more of kind of leaked information come out. But I think Giancarlo's was leaked before it happened as well. So more than likely this is happening, and I'm excited for it. We've talked kind of way too much in this podcast about remakes and reboots and everything else. And now we have another one happening.
Yep.
So Jennifer Aniston with 20th Century Studios is producing a reboot of the Dolly Parton, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, kind of classic from the 80s, 9 to 5. So, of course, that was a huge hit song for Dolly, but it was also a big film in the 80s about, you know, starring strong women and all the information. They're rebooting it now, which with anything being rebooted, I'm a little hesitant on, because that is a cult classic. That is a classic film. Doesn't need to be touched. It's going to be vastly different because of what the 80s is to how everything is today. But is it something, you know, necessary to do again? Like, instead of doing something original or new, we're going back to the well again and taking on another reboot.
So yeah, I mean, you make good points about, like, you know, how is it going to be made into a more modern telling of this story? Because, like you said, the way we were as a society in the 80s compared to how things are now, there's been a lot of advancements made for, you know, equality in the workplace and things of that nature. But there are definitely some interesting avenues they could tell this story in, because, you know, while we have come a long way, there's still a long way that we can go as far as, like, overall equality. There have been a lot of strides, like I said, over the last, you know, 40 years. But at the same time, you know, there are some interesting takes they can make on it. So I'm curious to see what direction they go with it. Is it more of a corporate type more of a corporate type story that they tell with it, or does it keep some of that, you know, charm that the, you know, the previous film had, which I could see maybe them trying to make a play on both, but yeah, it's such a weird thing to, like, some films, like you say, are so, like, important to the time that they're made in, that trying to reboot them in a different time and where we are as a society and then, you know, decades later at this point is, I don't know, I'm curious to see what they do with it, mm-hmm. because it's got potential to be, you know, really good. It all depends on, like we always come back to, is the story good? Is the casting on point? Is it, how well is it made? How well is it presented? There's so many things that can go wrong in a film, but nailing those parts can help a lot. So I'm curious to see what the setting for this is going to be.
Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah. Cause with what you touch on, it's been 40 plus years since it came out. There's a lot that's changed in every sense of society with men and women and all that. And it's more of just, like you said, we want to make sure they're doing right by it, that they're not kind of ruin the legacy and what they were trying to do in that first film by just doing something completely out of left field that just makes no sense to do. And, you know, hopefully they've got the right people behind it to do it. But my mind also, like, went to casting right away because you had with a connection to Dolly with Miley Cyrus, like thinking, like, if someone's going to do a modern version of 9 to 5 or something, it's probably going to be Miley.
It could be. Yeah, very well could be. And We'll continue to follow that and see, you know, how they cast this and how they move forward with it. But yeah, I think she would be fun. At the very, very least, she could do this, you know, the soundtrack for it. You know, I mean, make the title song for the film. Obviously, she's done, you know, Jolene and all that other, you know, and everything else is, you know, tribute to Dolly. So I'm sure she would have no problem, you know, doing a modern take on that song as well.
Yep.
But moving on to, you know, remakes and remasters. This year, there's a lot of films being re-released in theaters based on, you know, specific anniversaries and stuff. I know Sony's put out, like, all the Spider-Man films are putting out. We're also getting The Mummy coming out, Alien coming out, like a bunch of different anniversary screenings. It's fun to see the studios taking these, you know, classic films and re-releasing them in theaters. So, like, maybe if you didn't get to go see the movie in the theater in its proper settings, you know, when you were younger, for whatever reason, circumstances prevented you from going.
Not born yet.
Yeah, you weren't even born when these films came out in a lot of these cases. Like, the fact that they're putting out, and we got news this week that they're putting out the extended 4K remastered versions of the Lord of the Rings films. And we wanted to bring note of that because, you know, you and I are both huge fans of Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. We went and re-saw the films again when they were released in theaters during, like, the pandemic, during COVID time, when they weren't putting out new films and they were re-releasing some of these, that these both came out. But we're getting the full 4K extended versions now that are coming out, I believe, starting in June, first week of June, June 8th, around that time period. But I'm excited to see those films again. I know we were talking about before we went on recording this that we wanted to see it, but for me, those are some of my favorite films that have ever been made. Like, me personally, if I were to put a top 5 list of my favorite films of all time, Return of the King is number 1 in my book. That's my favorite movie of all time. So to see, you know, the full version in a theater setting, I'm excited for that.
Yeah, immediately when I saw that they were doing the 4K remasters in theaters again, I'm like, ooh, like, anything Lord of the Rings, you get my attention. Yeah. Like, I know the extended editions are 3 to 4 hours long, but I love it and I want to go. Like, it's hard. Like, can I carve out time to go see these? Because if for some reason you weren't able to see the Lord of the Rings in theaters, the extended editions, I wish they would also do the theatrical as well. Because, I mean, I love the extended editions. They add so much to it. But, you know, being able to see the theatrical run again would be great. But it is a time commitment. Like I said, it's 3.5, 4 hours. Plus, for some of these per film, so you're looking over 12 hours in the theater to see all three. But again, I'm like, maybe, like, let's go back and revisit. So, yeah, I absolutely love what Peter Jackson did with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And we talked a little bit, just, we know The Hobbit had its issues. Sure, a lot of it came from the studio. Yeah. But, you know, the first three, the original book of Lord of the Rings that they did, I thought it was masterful, and I will always love those films.
Yeah, I mean, those are my, I call them my snowy day movies. So if, like, it's the weekend, it's snowing out, for those of you that get to experience snow, and you're kind of stuck in the house, that's a film that I will pass some time on to watch. And, you know, I, like I said, Return of the King is my favorite film of all time. Mm-hmm. So I'm at bare minimum, if I don't go see all three of them, I'm going to see that one again, because it's such a masterpiece of filmmaking that, you know, the fact that they're putting it out, I'm very excited for.
Yep. So a franchise that's been going since, what, the late 70s, early 80s is Evil Dead. And, you know, we've had some more modern remakes. We've had continuations. Well, it's not dying anytime soon, because it was just announced that a new film in the Evil Dead franchise will be coming out from Francis Galluppi. Again, I apologize. I am the name butcherer. They did The Last Stop in Yuma County. Going to be taking on the new Evil Dead film.
See, that's exciting. I love Evil Dead. I know they've even spun it into a game that you can play. The games were surprisingly really good too. And you know, the fact that they're making another film on this, like you said, we talk a lot about reboots and remakes and sequels, and this franchise, like you said, it got some new legs here in like the last, you know, 10 years or so with like Ash versus the Evil Dead. And you know, the fact that they're continuing to tell these stories, you and I are both fans of the original movies with Bruce Campbell as well, you know, it's exciting to see where they take the series from here, because, you know, you kind of feel like, have they gone to the well enough for that? But they keep finding, like, entertaining stories for this. So as long as they keep that moving, why not, right?
Yeah, originally just didn't seem like a franchise that you would see to have this long. I mean, you know, Sam Raimi started it. It's one of his, you know, original films that really skyrocketed him and got his start, which I can't remember what he did before that, but that's kind of when people think of Sam Raimi. You've got Toby Spider-Man, and you've got, you know, Evil Dead.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bruce Campbell, that's his legacy, is those first two Evil Dead films. So yeah, when they did the reboot or the remake of it, 10, 15 years ago now, I was like, it wasn't bad, but I didn't just see that it was going to be spawning all these films, but it's doing good. Like, they've seemed to have done a good job. I haven't seen the last one. It looked creepy as all could be.
Yeah.
Haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but yeah, it's good on them to keep this franchise going.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to talking to you about it when you do sit down and watch it. But yeah, they're keeping it going, man. That's it's good for them. They seem to have a lot of energy behind it, and they have people willing to come in and take over and, you know, keep it going. So as long as the entertainment value's there, well, you know what I mean? Moving in, we had a couple movies get announced this week that they've been delayed, so we wanted to bring that information to everybody. The next installment of The Karate Kid, speaking of reboots and remakes, the next Karate Kid film, which was, I believe, starring Ralph Macchio and Jackie Chan together?
Yeah, they're kind of combining what they did originally with The Karate Kid with the new reboot with Jackie Chan and Jaden Smith, and kind of combining that into one film, which I'm really want to see if Cobra Kai has any, you know, that series any tie-in to this film as well.
Yeah, because that's a huge hit, and I know that's the next season, which I believe is going to be the final season of that's getting ready to come out eventually. That's being worked on too, but the Karate Kid film that they're making has been delayed until May of next year, so there is a delay in that. It was slated to come out later this year, but it did get pushed until end of May next year, so there's something to keep an eye on for there as well. Another film that's been kind of up and down as to how people feel about it is the Sony Marvel property Kraven the Hunter, starring Aaron Taylor Johnson, who we've mentioned at the beginning of the show. That film has been pushed from, I want to say, in August to December. I can't remember when the original release date for it was, but it's been moved to the end of the year. So it's getting an end-of-the-year release. December 13th is when that one's coming out. So we wanted to keep an eye on that as well.
Yeah, I'm still mixed up. We got, you know, Venom the Last Dance, I believe, it's out in October. Yep. Now we have Kraven in December. Like, the Venom films have done well for Sony, but outside of those with their Marvel properties since, you know, the original Spider-Man films, we know Madame Web, we know Morbius, all those haven't done well. So I'm kind of mixed on Kraven, just because Sony hasn't had the best track record outside of their joint efforts with the MCU of putting some together, and having a delay without really information on why it's delayed, I don't know if that bodes too well for Kraven.
Yeah, we'll keep it on, and hopefully it keeps that date. So we'll keep everybody updated as that, you know, as we continue to get some of these, like, fringe, I don't want to call them fringe films, but definitely not core to the main story, like, get delayed and pushed off. Because it's, like you said, it's always a red flag. Like, are they expecting it to just not perform well, so they're moving it to a time of the year where it may be competing with something that's bigger at around that time? Because delaying it to December is not insignificant because there's a lot of, like, there are certain pockets of the year where bigger films get released, and Christmas time around that time is one of those times of year where they put some big films out. So I don't know if they're confident, if that means they're confident in the movie, or they're like, okay, we're not as confident, we're going to put it out with something that's probably going to get a little more traction and just, you know, put it out there for people.
Because I can't remember how many superhero films have released in December. I don't think there's been that many, but I can't really pinpoint how many, because normally they're the tent poles of the summer and the fall and not as much in the winter.
And it feels more of a DC thing, right? DC tends to do more of them towards the end of the year. So the fact that Marvel property is getting that treatment, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Marvel, we did get a little more information about Scarlett Johansson's secret project that she's doing. So we now know it's going to be a Disney Plus series. We still don't know what the subject matter is about. So she's going to be executive producing and helping develop the series, but we don't know if she's going to appear in it in any way, if it's going to be anything related to Black Widow with, you know, Florence Pugh's new version of the Black Widow with Yelena. But we know it's coming to Disney Plus.
I'm excited because she, you know, she had such a great run as Black Widow that, you know, she finally got her individual movie that she had always wanted to make, got that put out. And the fact that she's coming back to work on additional things, it's exciting. I'm a little curious, like you said, to keep, you know, an eye on what it actually is and how it's going to tie into things, if it's going to tie into things, and just see what she's been working on, because I love Scarlett Johansson. I think she's a fantastic actress. And the fact that she's coming back to work on something, it's exciting. Like, I don't necessarily think it's going to be exactly Black Widow, but
I think it's going to be a new property that people aren't going to expect that she's helping develop.
I'm excited for that, so we'll keep an eye on that for sure.
Yeah, because as we talked about with Tom Holland and Robert Downey Jr., you a lot of these actors, once their time was done, the MCU are seemingly done, for now, talking about walking away, we thought she was also one that was going to, you know, pretty much walk away for a while of where, you know, her character ended up. Now, I guess trying to avoid spoilers, but I think by now everyone knows that Black Widow is no longer in the MCU, that she sacrificed herself. And we thought, well, she's done. But yeah, now it's talking like she's still going to be keeping her hand pretty well in the cookie jar of Marvel and helping them develop stuff. And, you know, maybe we'll see in Multiverse where, you know, Black Widow will pop back up, but she's also heading back into action with the Jurassic World reboot as well. So she's not shying away from going back to action.
Yeah, I love it. So I'm definitely going to keep an eye on, like, when that finally comes out, what she's working on. Because they're doing a pretty good job of keeping it under wraps. There's, like, almost no information on what exactly she's working on, so that's definitely something.
Which I'm kind of glad. Like, we're reporting on what we know about it, but we don't want to give spoilers away. We like to be surprised by films when they come out, so it's nice that we're kind of keeping some information unknown when it comes to this.
Right. So I'm going to use that opportunity to transition to the one thing I wanted to talk about before we get into our TV breakdown. It's one of the biggest news stories of the week. It is the full trailer for the next trailer for Deadpool and Wolverine. So there's a lot that happened in this trailer, and I kind of wanted to just talk about it with you and kind of get your initial thoughts on, you know, what happened, like some of the Easter eggs that they're throwing into the trailer itself. And there's still so much about the full, like we have an idea, I think, at this point of what some of the plot of the film is going to be, but there's just, they're throwing so much at us right now. It's crazy.
Give me the movie now.
I know that I want it at that rate. We're like, okay, we're about 3 months away as the time of recording of getting this film finally. So just give us the film already.
Every time something new comes out for it, I just tell Josh, that's another screening that we're adding to it. I think we're up like six or seven,
see this movie a lot.
But yeah, I mean, the trailer gave us quite, I mean, it still showed us a lot of the stuff that we got in the teaser. They're not trying to show too much away, but we did get quite a lot, and even some stuff that I'm just now bringing back in my head. So this is going to be a little light and spoiler, but it's a trailer, so it's not the movie. It's what we got, because there's a lot of in-jokes that happen in this trailer that even I think people are still going through and trying to find, because one of the ones that got me laughing right away was Rob Liefeld's Just Feet store was in the background of with the nice slow-mo walk of Wolverine and Deadpool coming into frame, which we get Wolverine, so fans can be happy now after the first teaser, like, why does Wolverine have sleeves? Hugh Jackman has ripped off the sleeves, and he got jacked again to play Wolverine. But, like, if anybody doesn't know about Rob, the creator of Deadpool and Cable and all that, he doesn't really like to draw feet. He's struggled, and there's been some jokes where right feet look like left feet, and they look tiny, or he'll just try to hide them. So to have a shoe store, feet store for him in the background is such a great in-joke, and paying a nice homage to him, to the creator of Deadpool, because he's actually ending his like involvement and run with Deadpool this year. He's got, I think, one more comic book or series coming out for Deadpool, and he's retiring from the character.
That's crazy, because he's been a part of that character for so long now. And like you said, if you go back and read any of the comics that he's made, a lot of times you're not going to notice like boots or feet for those characters. It's a funny in joke, and they're keeping it in. Deadpool's at its core a very meta character anyway, so the fact that they're throwing that in there is a subtle little like, hey, you know. It's like paying homage to the man at the same time. So there's just so much going on in this trailer, though. Like, there's one scene in particular that fans have kind of caught on to that made a little side video about it, where there's Deadpool in a fight scene, and he's moving a certain way. And if you pay attention to how he's moving, it's shot for shot a remake of the Spider-Man 1 fight scene with Tobey Maguire and Joe Manganiello with Peter Parker and Flash Thompson, where he's finally learning, like, his natural like defense movements as Spider-Man, and it's literally a shot-for-shot remake of
same moves,
you know, just moving in and out and like ducking and avoiding straight. It's so funny, but like that's the attention to detail that they're paying in the film that it's giving us as much excitement for this as they can, because we don't even have enough time to list all the Easter eggs in this that they're doing, because it's just covering so much of the entire broad spectrum of Marvel from, you know, original films to now. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, there was one, and it's only like maybe 2 seconds, where we see an Ant-Man helmet open up and we have a skull inside that has so many Easter eggs in it, because, well, one, you have giant dead Ant-Man that's been turned into like Cassandra Nova's base, it seems, which she's in a wheelchair, which looks like Professor X's wheelchair. And then standing outside there, you have potentially the original actors for Lady Deathstrike and Azazel, and I think someone also pointed out that Ray Park was there as Toad, and he was part of that scene. So like, there's just a line of mutants that, like, at first, because you miss it because you're looking at the Ant-Man helmet open, and you go back and look, and like, wait, that's that, yes, like, there's a ton of characters.
Yeah, which
there
is another direct, you know, a direct pull from a comic as well, because there is a comic book series where Ant-Man had passed away at his, you know, maximum size, and then revert back, and like his body becomes like part of nature. It's a whole thing. The words can't do it justice, but it is straight adapted from a comic book too. And there's so much, you know, so much into it at this point that it's like, how much. It's going to take like 6 or 7 viewings to catch everything at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I think it really there's is so many in-jokes.
Because they're doing so many, like, it's so, I love when they do that, because it gives you all the more reason to pay attention to these films. Like, even in the trailer, they're jumping through a portal, like a Doctor Strange-made portal or some kind of magical portal, and you don't see what they're jumping to, and I like that they're keeping it a secret, because you could probably very clearly tell that's important where they're going. Mm-hmm. So it's they're giving us just enough that, like, oh, they're about to do this. Like, we know the TVA is going to be heavily involved in it, because we've seen it, and, you know, that tie into Loki and everything like that, and the story that started there, and, you know, it's going to be a lot of time jumping, a lot of universe jumping. So it's going to be an incredibly wild ride when it comes out.
Yeah, I don't know. These created a lot of debate with that portal, and being, because if you've watched any of the Doctor Strange films, you know it shows the location of where they're going. So clearly there's a big location that if you see you're going right away, and there's already several, and I kind of believe the same thing, that maybe they're jumping into an Avengers film, maybe it's Endgame or Age of Ultron or something else is that they're going to be jumping into. Like, I can just imagine Deadpool and Wolverine joining the fight of Thanos in Endgame. And because, you know, probably not going to refilm much other than what Deadpool and Wolverine are doing and just putting the footage in the background. But give me what, you know, we never really got with, you know, Hulk and Wolverine fighting of a big leaping stab of some. Have him, Wolverine, leap and stab Thanos with his claws, and like, just give me something like that. But there's so much, like, there's so many Easter eggs. There's, like, we're planning to see it multiple times a lot, because I think we're going to have a blast with it. But there's going to be so much to try to decipher and see if that they've thrown in. And there's even rumors that that the extra credit scene is just going to blow people's minds, that they got away with what they're doing with that. So it's like,
so excited.
It can't be July soon enough.
it's definitely one. It's by far our most anticipated film of the year. But I do think it, even like buzz everywhere, it's going to be the most anticipated Marvel film since No Way Home, I think. The buzz around that. And we saw how well No Way Home did. And it made so much money. And I think this is going to be the Deadpool movie that, you know, in my opinion, is going to break all kinds of box office records for that. It's going to shatter anything he did with Deadpool before, which the previous two Deadpool movies made a lot of money, too. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not insignificant, but I think it's going to just explode way past anything he's done before, because it's going to be insane.
Absolutely. Moving on to our TV breakdowns this week. So we have X-Men 97 Episode 7 Bright Eye. So, you know, this kind of picks us back up after the Remember It episode where we're seeing the fallout. So we're starting out, and this is going to have some light spoilers again. We're episode 7. We've only got 3 episodes left. We're moving into, and that's a part, you know, 1, 2, and 3. So we're moving into the finale here. So if you're invested in it yet, you should have, you know, already seen it, but just a warning again, there's going to be some light spoilers. So, you know, we start the episode right off with Gambit's funeral.
Yeah, just right out the gate, man. It was such a gut punch at the end. Heartbreaking. We've talked about it ad nauseum in the show before, but it picks up right from there. So they go and right into the funeral, and conspicuous by her absence is Rogue. So Rogue is very much grieving at this point. She's kind of on her own, doing her own thing. And then we pick up a little bit beyond that with Rogue and what Rogue's been up to, and she is on a mission for payback, that is for sure. Vengeance. She's out for vengeance everywhere, you know what I mean? She's looking specifically for the people responsible for creating this, you know, overpowered Sentinel and causing the death and destruction of everything, and, you know, just trying to get some revenge for Gambit at this point. So she's on the hunt for Bolivar Trask and for Henry Gyrick, who were the two people most responsible for, you know, this happening. At least that's what they're aware of at this point.
Yeah, like creating the Sentinel program, and that's what this mega Sentinel came and, you know, killed so many people. And I absolutely love that first action sequence with Rogue, because, you know, as I've touched on, I enjoyed Anna Paquin as a live-action Rogue to a point, because she was the damsel in distress.
Yeah.
We didn't get a Rogue that was powerful and strong, but also weak and sensitive and everything else. And this, we got just Rogue on a rampage, and like, hey, this is a private U.S. military base, and you can't,
she
just smashing tanks and crushing. And then we got a nice little cameo by, you know, Thunderbolt Ross, like, yeah, we built this facility to hold Hulk, like, what is the little girl gonna do? And she smashes through the ceiling, right, like, yeah, like, I think a lot of people, especially because, you know, a generation may only know Rogue from those live actions, like, she is an extremely powerful character.
Yeah, both emotionally and physically. Like, she's a beast, man. She's incredible, and they get her on full display here, and it leads to a very awesome cameo as well that was teased a little bit in the, you know, the trailers for the series, and everybody was like, how is it going to play in? She winds up running across, spoiler alert, Captain America in this, and, you know, Captain's also on the hunt trying to figure out what's going on, but the way they present Cap in this is Cap is, you know, on their side, but he's trying to do things by the book, you know, the right way, and, you know, keeping everything is inside the lines of, you know, morality at this point, which is very on brand for Captain America. But you get this kind of showdown between her and him where, like, it doesn't get physical in any sense, but there is some dialogue back and forth, and she's like, you're going to do this by the book, but I'm not.
I love the pettiness of Rogue, because she was holding on to his shield, and he's telling her that I'm doing it by the book, and she's like, I'm not. So she just chucks his shield away, like, all right, go fetch. Now you got to go try to find your shield, or I'm going to go fly away and go get him. Like, I just so love funny. That pettiness.
It was so good, because she did not care. She was like, all right, you can do it however you want to do. Because the way they see it is, like, obviously she's flying, and, like, she gets hit with the shield, and, you know, it lands in the ground, and that's where you see this, you know, the still shot from, you know, the trailer for the show. And it's such a cool interaction, because, like you said, the pettiness, and she just flies up in the air, chucks it as far as she can, and it's way, like, it's going to take Cap a minute to find that shield. So she goes on, and they finally track, you know, Henry Gyrich down, and, you know, there's a scene there where she's trying to get the information from him. He's being a little smug about it. Like, oh, you're not going to do anything. Well, she does something about it. And, you know, she gets a little bit of revenge there. And then the hunt for Bolivar Trask is on. And, you know, it's just, it's such a heavy episode because she goes through this entire rampage and then she winds up down in New Orleans, like you find out, and she's, you know, she finally gets to process some of that grief a little bit.
I love that scene. And they're all there for her
too. Like you see Nightcrawler show up first. And if you know anything about their relationship in the comics, it's very brother sister-y kind of, and they lean into it. He calls her sister and everything, you know, like there's a real nice, sweet, emotional moment to where she's like, so she's been so focused on, you know, the revenge portion of this that she finally starts to, you know, embrace, you know, her grief a little bit. And, you know, the fact that they're all there for her, it was a really touching moment for sure.
Yeah, and then we take a turn because, you know, Trask ends up reaching out that, you know, he's feeling some remorse for the stuff he did and that and saying, like, I wasn't really a part of it. They used my DNA and other stuff to go on with it, and wants to meet with them. But then we get Rogue going, well, Rogue. Well, yeah. You know, they're on a rooftop, and he looks like he's ready to end his life, and he's, like, done with it all. And she grabs him, and like, yep, even through all of her emotional turmoil, she's going to help save the day. And, well, he reveals what he knew, and then she releases him. And, like, all right, she's going to fly down and crash. Okay. Rogue just let him die, and you get that another powerful emotional scene because she turns around to the rest of the X-Men who are like, what did you just do? And she's crying and just laying everything out, but then that literally goes explosive right afterwards.
Yeah, because then you get the reveal of what actually happened to Bolivar Trask and what he's become, and it just takes off, and we finally find out who's behind the entire thing. You think it's Mr. Sinister, but even Mr. Sinister has, you know, someone he's reporting to, and you get the reveal of who the actual big bad is for this, and it's a character by the name of Bastion. So Bastion is, you know, kind of this mold hybrid combination of, like, the characters Nimrod and Mastermind, I believe.
It's kind of like a human form of those robots together,
and he's the mastermind behind all of this, and you start to see, you know, even the control he has over Mr. Sinister, that he, you know, he's very much a threat, and he kind of leads you to believe that that overpowered Sentinel is just the, you know, tip of the iceberg for what he has planned. So it's setting up an incredible last three episodes of this season. I don't know what they're going to do because they've done a very good job of, sorry, I know you're about to jump in, but like they're doing such a good job of keeping everybody on their toes with this. Like they don't do everything that's expected in this. And I love that from a storytelling perspective because it's so easy to, you know, they could have done the whole, yeah, she's upset and on a vengeance, but she could have still at the end done the right thing and saved, you know, this man that was trying to, you know, throw himself off of a building. And she doesn't. And then they're like, even they pivot and like the X-Men are like, oh, is this what we've become? Is this what we're doing now? Like there's that whole interpersonal dynamic that's still got to play out while still dealing with this very real threat. And I love it. It's engaging. Mm-hmm. It keeps you on your toes as a viewer. And I like it. It's not plot twist for the sake of plot twist because the things that happen make sense. And I'm so happy they're doing it that way.
You know, like Bastion is a kind of a deeper cut villain, maybe not always the best received in the comic stories he's been a part of, but he is a deeper cut villain that you didn't kind of expect. I mean, it's tied in to the Sentinels and keeping the Sentinels front and center, but I didn't expect to see him show up. And then we did get a reveal at the very end that he, someone we thought that was dead, is being alive and well and kept by Bastion in his dungeon or his lair. And you know, we don't know what that's going to mean for his character or anything going forward. But yeah, that's, as we mentioned, you know, this is episode 7, 8, 9, and 10 are listed as a part 1, 2, and 3. So we got a 3-part finale coming up. So there's a lot that's going to be happening in these next few episodes to get us to our conclusion. And yeah, we're still just, we don't know what the conclusion is going to be because we've got, you know, needing Cable, and we had Cable show up again here and, you know, help defeat the Sentinel human hybrid Trask. And we got the reveal with Cyclops, that Cyclops now knows who he is, that he's his Nathan. But are we going to get Cable resetting timelines to bring characters back. Could we be. Still haven't had Charles, you know, in the last episode, we learned that he's alive. He's going to be coming back. He hasn't come back yet. So there's still a lot of threads that they've opened to be weaved through these next three episodes.
Yeah, and to kind of go back to what we were talking about before, where we were talking about how, like, incredible the episode two episodes ago was, and it was such a gut punch. We're like, how can they get better? And this is a reminder to kind of tie that back in, where the original creator of this series, or the original head of the series who was let go before this started, mentioned, you know, episodes 8, 9, and 10 are going to be absolutely insane. If you thought 5 was crazy, you're not ready for 8, 9, and 10. We're here now. So 8, 9, and 10 are here. They're about to be crazy. And I'm excited to see if they are as crazy as he's sold them to be, because, like you said, It's been a ride up to this point, but there's a three-parter for a reason. Like, it's going to do a lot of crazy stuff. So I'm anticipating a lot of emotional stuff, a lot of, you know, powerful, awesome fights, and, you know, just at least two cliffhangers at this point, because you got to tell the story in three parts. So I'm excited to see how they flow this story over the course of the next three episodes, because I'm having so much fun watching this.
Yeah, and Marvel loves what's they've done with it, and they've already talked that they hope it goes on for a while more, and probably doing seasons back to back so they can get them out a little quicker. So I'm glad that hopefully we end season one on a great note. It's been fantastic so far. Like I said, we don't know what to expect, because episode 5 is such, kind of set all of our expectations to expect the unexpected, and you don't know if any of these deaths or anything are going to be permanent, if they're going to come back, how exactly they're going to do this moving on. But all 7 episodes of X-Men 97 are available on Disney Plus. New episodes on Wednesday. So, like I said, we're starting with episode 8. This is the build up to our finale. Part 1 of the finale is beginning, and we're getting close to the end for this season 1 of X-Men 97. Sure. But of course, it's the continuation of the X-Men the animated series.
Love it. It was one of my favorite cartoons as a kid, and it's come back, and I'm just as much in love with it now as I was back then. So excited to see where they move forward with that. Now moving on to what is unfortunate for us, because we've loved this show so much up to this point. We are at episode 10, the season/series finale of Shogun. It's called A Dream of a Dream, and it's the conclusion of this entire story that we've had coming up. So I want to start off by saying, you know, we gave Mariko her flowers in this last episode. We'd start right away with knowing how that played out. So we know, you know, Mariko is unfortunately gone, and you deal with the ramifications of that, and it moves forward, right? So it's like, we're jumping right in. We're not messing around, because there's a lot of things to tie up at this point. And I know we had certain expectations of where we thought this, like how this was going to end, with some big, incredible, violent battle that we were expected to see. But they decided to take a little bit more of a subtle approach with this finale, where, yes, the battle happened, but we don't really see it, but we see kind of like the Cliff Notes version of it, which I'm minimalizing it in a sense when I'm saying that, but they do a very smart way of telling you what happened without maybe necessarily blowing a budget on a big battle scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I said, from my understanding, it ended just like the book did. But yeah, most people, and I think I've seen people being a little split on it, because we were expecting this whole series as setting up to this giant action sequence, but we ended up getting, and it ties into what I've said before of Torinaga being the master chess player. Yes. This whole series, he's been doing moves and moves, and we finally get the revelations of everything that he's been doing. But kind of go back to Mariko a little bit, like, you know, we touched in the last episode, which was called Crimson Sky. We're like, well, we didn't really get Crimson Sky. Well, we learn we did. Mariko was Crimson Sky. Yeah. And Torinaga is laying it kind of all out here and says that, you know, I sent a woman to do what an army could never do. Like, she was Crimson Sky, and she did. She changed everything. And, you know, we get kind of a dual look at Torinaga, because we're looking at him in multiple different ways after we learn all this information. So, you know, this episode just kind of goes layer by layer, breaking down of where we're seeing, because, like I said, we're waiting on the battle, but, you know, we end up getting John and Yabu return, but while they're returning, you know, Yabu is pleading with John, hey, let's go back to England. Let's just leave. Let's not do anything. Because he knows he's waiting on death. He's crossed Tornaga too many times. His cross ended up leading to Mariko dying. He knows he's meeting his fate. And Tornaga, which I had to laugh at, just the bluntness of it. Like, he has Yabu in front of him talking about everything. Yabu admits, like, yeah, I crossed you again. And Tornaga's just like, all right, kill yourself by sunset. Just bluntly, frills, no holding anything back. Just kill yourself by sunset.
Yeah, it's over. Like, it's done. Like, it, and it gets, you know, I think he gives him a day. Mm-hmm. Like you said, by sunset tomorrow, I believe, is what he said. And gives him a little bit of time. But, yeah, like, he's done. He's done for. Like, there's no more running at this point. They get, you know, you get all these threads in this. They do a nice job of wrapping everything up, I believe. Like, they really did so well in telling, you know, you get the full details of Torunaga's plan, and it's told throughout this entire episode of how everything was masterminded, every different string that he pulled, because he does. You get this scene where, you know, he asks Yabu who he wants to second him, because we talk about the whole honor, and, you know, you start by making the cut of yourself, and then eventually your second comes behind and, you know, finishes you off, so you don't technically, because it's kind of a soul-saving thing that they view it as or whatever, and it's wild, and he goes and he lays out so much stuff, because he more or less says, you know, what's the point in telling everything to a dead man, you know, that kind of thing, and he lays out so much of his, everything that he did up to this point. Like, you get this revelation that, you know, Mariko gets John's life spared by, you know, making a deal with, you know, the Portuguese at this point, you know,
who John came to fight and attack and take over. Yeah. She makes a deal with him to spare his life.
Yeah. And it comes at the cost of sinking his ship. And, you know, there's so many things there. Like, you get that nice thread there. There's a very fun, interaction between Blackthorn and Torunaga that you finally get to see at the end, where, you know, they kind of laugh with each other, like, okay, like, respectfully, like, you're fine, you're okay, you can, you know, go on about and live your life, you know, as you need to, you'll get your ship back, you got to rebuild it, and it's a fun interaction, like, okay, you'll get your ship back, but you got to build me a fleet too. So he does give John a little bit of a purpose.
Yeah, because, not to interrupt you, taking that moment, like, John is offering to end his life. Like, he is laying himself down in front of Torunaga because, you know, Torunaga is tearing through the village trying to find the person who burned down a ship. Yeah. He thinks there is a spy. There's somebody inside the village that did this. So he's going through people. And John's like, don't punish them. You know, take my life in exchange for leaving the village alone. He's like, no. And so John's just like, I'm going to do it anyways. And he goes to do it. And you get that moment where, yeah, like, Torunaga runs up and grabs a sword before he can take his own life and punches him. And then he's like, yeah. So why don't you just rebuild your ship and build me a fleet? And
yeah, I was working around. I was working around. Sorry. To get to that.
I was just like, that just popped in my head. And I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, it gets to the, you know, point where you're talking about, like, him being the master strategist and chess player. He was like, oh yeah, that was all a ruse to prove his loyalty to me. Like, it was like, this guy is willing to go to, like, some insane lengths to get to where he wants to be. And by the end of the episode, you get to, you know, the ultimate conclusion of how everything ends, right? So it does, we're 10 episodes in, this is spoiler time, obviously, he winds up as the Shogun, like, he winds up winning the battle, and it's this whole Crimson Sky thing that you mentioned, like, he gets everybody to turn on Ishido, even Lady Achiba's done with him at this point, you know what I mean? And eventually he works it out to where, you know, they're getting ready to meet on this battlefield and have this ginormous battle. Well, Ochiba's army doesn't show up. The other regents turn on him as well. So, Shido's more like on his own at this point because everybody's rallied around Torunaga at this point. So it's like Ishido's at this battle with no backup. Like, it's the people that are loyal directly to him, and that's it. And it's like this entire thing, you're thinking everybody's gunning at Torunaga, and he completely flips a 180 on Ishido and is like, no, it's not happening. Like, it's you get the the sense of how the battle goes without having to do the actual battle. Mm-hmm. I think we're so conditioned to, because we've talked about it the entire time we've done it, like there's going to be some big fight scene because it's been building to that the entire time. But what I like about it is they didn't have to go through the entire brutality to tell mm-hmm. what happened to it. And I can get how that could be divisive between people because people are so conditioned to want to see the battle and just the grand epicness of what it could be. And at the end, like, I think they've used the violence to kind of the violent parts of the show to move along, you know, the story in a way that impacts the story. And that battle is just a battle to have a battle. It kind of feels like, and it hasn't necessarily been the theme of the entire show. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. That's my approach to it. I don't know if you feel any different.
This ending, I say, is poetic.
Very much so.
Poems and all that has been an underlying layer of the entire series, especially with Crimson Sky and this finale yes. of poems being written and the meanings and stuff. It was a very poetic ending because, yeah, we didn't have the war. We have Toranaga putting checkmate down because, you know, we went through the series where Toranaga is, you know, basically because he doesn't want to turn on the heir. He's the only one actually trying to protect the heir, we think. Because at the end, it's kind of like, what was his true motivations in a right. way? Because you kind of see him in a couple different lights because, you know, throughout the series, he's saying, I don't want more bloodshed. I actually don't want to go to war. I don't want to fight. I don't want to battle, but we may have to do some bloodshed. And but, you know, we got episode 7 and 8, where he's really adamant that I am not going to spill any more blood. I'm just going to give up, turn it in, which we know that was a ruse, but it was at the same point he was able to pretty much win a war without going to war yeah. because he was able to manipulate and get Mariko and Buntaru's dad. I'm trying to think of his name and I completely forgot, you know, he lost many people, but yes. in a strategic chess, like, these are my pawns, these are my knights, these are my rooks, this is everybody I'm moving in, and they're going to be taken from me, but in the end, their sacrifice is going to win this war without ever fighting a battle or really needing to fight a battle, and he becomes shogun, and he is the victorious one, but at the same time, like, he said he never wanted to be shogun, but at the end, it's like, secretly, yeah, he wanted to be shogun.
I think at the end of the day, he kind of saw where things were going, and my interpretation of it is he came to the realization that he needed to be, mm-hmm. at least for now, until the heir was ready, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it was like, okay, if somebody's going to make a power grab, it's in better hands to be with me, who may necessarily have the heir's best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. Because I think you do, because he literally lays it out in the episode where he's like, I know I can't take my army and march on Osaka and win. I know I can't. It's impossible. So he's like, I have to turn this in a way that would bring people to my side to where I don't have to fight. And you kind of get that whole full circle moment there, because mm-hmm. That's exactly how it has to happen, right? There's not a ton of bloodshed. There's not this grand epic battle. And you can see if, you know, Ishido is, you can maybe draw a conclusion that he may have been stubborn in that moment and tried to fight anyway, and they took care of him fairly quickly. We don't know. They don't lay that part out of it, but it does end with him, you know, in the seat right there, you know, because he even talks about, you know, removing the capital from Osaka to Edo, where he's from, and there being this grand, you know, time of peace, that mm-hmm. there's no more war, and, you know, just moving the capital and just centering everything where everything's nicely set up for him. And it's like you said, it's been poetic the entire time. They're quoting poetry the entire mm-hmm. series. So the fact that it ends in that type of poetic way is really nice. And then one of the neatest, like, little tiny threads that they fill up at the end, and I don't know why I enjoyed it as much as I did, because at the heart of this conflict was the love triangle between John Blackthorn, Buntaro, and Mariko, right? Mm-hmm. So Mariko is married to Buntaro. They had their marital issues, and it's played out in both a beautiful and dramatic and sad way, for depending on how you look at it. One of the very last scenes of the series here is John getting a crew of people to try to pull his wrecked ship out of the mm-hmm. ocean, and they can't move it. They can only move it to a certain point, and he's about to give up. like pulling this out of here. He's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. Well, who winds up showing up? It's Buntaro. And Buntaro, like, they have this stare down, and he, like, bows to him, and they bow back, and he's like, I'll help you pull your ship out of the wreck. Yeah. It was just a nice little, like...
Nice, yeah, I love that, because even Buntaro never spoke in the episode. He never spoke, but we got enough of him and John kind of paying respects to each other, because they just stare at each other, and they bow, and, you know, John's handed some water after they're done, and he immediately just hands it straight to Buntaro and goes over to look at Torunaga. Like, they were to say what they needed to say their looks. And I said, that's where I felt this whole series and this finale was so poetic. And one other aspect I really wanted to touch on was, I thought it was such a nice little thread throughout here, was John and Fuji-sama. You know, his consort, who's made to live in the house with him, serve him, you know, after her husband and son were killed in the very first episode, because he was going to run up and take on Ishido for disrespecting his lord. And we've kind of had that going, oh, well, it gets an ending, because, you know, they end up sitting down and talking to each other. And, you know, John's Japanese has been getting so much better. Sure. He's able to have a conversation. And she tells him that, hey, my service to Torunaga is done. You know, I'm going to go become a nun. And you can see throughout this episode up to that point, he's still heartbroken over Mariko. And he's like, trying to process everything, and he literally asks her, will you stay? And she says no, and like, well, then I order you to stay, and like, you can't order me to stay. But, you know, that could have been it, but we also got a really nice moment between them that he's doing something that is not traditionally Japanese. He takes, you know, her and her husband and son's ashes, along with the cross that represented Mariko, out into the water, and he's teaching her about how ceremoniously she could spread their ashes out and not just carry the burden of having her husband and son around to spread the ashes out. But he also learns, like, well, yeah, I'm still holding on to Mariko here. And, you know, I kind of let go, because we kind of start the episode off with, we now know, I guess it's more of a dream sequence. We're seeing John in bed in England as an old man grasping on to that cross, but in the end we see, well, no, that's not a future that's ever going to happen, because he let it go. It's at the bottom of the lake that they were at. And I just thought that was such a, again, with going with poetic throughout this, that was such a nice interaction between those two, because most of their interactions were kind of butting heads with each other, because she's serving him, but she doesn't really want to. You see him, don't like a lot of the stuff he does, thinks he's smelly and doesn't do stuff for it. But at the end, they have a respect for each other, and I thought that was just a really nice touch to wrap up their time and everything together.
Yeah, and everything does wrap up very well, right? Mm-hmm. So you get the conclusion of everything. In my opinion, a beautiful way to end this series. So looking back on it now, through 10 episodes, it is such an amazingly told story, such a beautiful story arc that I see now how it's done at this point. Mm-hmm. So you can speculate if they'll ever do like a John Blackthorne spinoff or something, which I could see, but in this particular story, how it's wrapped up in 10 episodes, because it's so well done. We cannot stress enough, if you haven't watched it yet, please take the time to go and watch this series, because it's so good. Like, it's brilliantly acted. It's a smart script. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got drama, comedy, action, you know,
romance a little bit.
Yeah, and it touches on so many different notes, and they all are done tastefully and really well.
It's actually extremely deep and emotional and poetic. Like I said, the whole series, once you finish this and you go back and look at it, like, all the underlying threads that they opened up and how everything was weaved and tied together, and just the poeticness of the whole story and how everything was done. Like, it is one of my favorite series of all time, and I'm probably going to go back and rewatch and binge. I may rewatch with the dubbed version, just to see how different it feels with not having the Japanese, just because I know everything that goes with it. Like I said, every actor did such an incredible job. We talked about how Anna should have so many awards, but they're, you know, the actor for Lord Torunaga, and amazing, even more, like, everybody did everything so well, and it's such a well-rounded, well-told, well-acted, just, there's nothing that this series really did wrong. Like, you could wonder in episodes what's going on here, but it was all part of, You know, you just had to wait for that story to finish telling. And it's like brilliant storytelling. The writers, everybody. I mean, it's based off of a book. I went out, I purchased both because I think there's two volumes of this story. I got both of them. I'm going to be reading it because absolutely. I loved what they tell to see. But they did such an amazing job with this adaptation and telling the story. And yeah, I cannot recommend everyone checking this out because it is unbelievably good.
Yeah, it's definitely one I plan on now that we've got the entire series and we've watched it week by week. I would love to go do a redo just to pick up anything I may have missed along the way. But they, like I said, they do such a good job of wrapping everything up nicely that I'd if I never saw it again, I would still hold, you know, the same respect and love for the show that I have. And I'm not, I don't think I'm out of pocket to say that this is a show come Emmy season next year is going to
absolutely
at least be very heavily nominated because there are a lot of things that are so brilliant. Like visually, it's stunning. The acting's amazing. It's going to get a lot of award show buzz next year when the Emmys come back around. I'm very confident in saying that. We don't throw that around a ton, especially when we heap praise upon something, but this is one for sure that's going to get a lot of nominations.
So even knowing now that they filmed this show that was all set in Japan, it was filmed in Vancouver.
I know. Crazy.
So from, you know, given the flowers and props to the set designers and everyone who just helped visually create these towns and worlds, like it was an incredible job that if I didn't know that, I wouldn't have guessed that, because, I mean, it's 1600s Japan, so, I mean, they have to recreate everything, but I wouldn't have thought that that was filmed outside, that was filmed in Canada.
Right, and it's such an amazing journey that we got to go on for this. I'm so happy that we did. I'm happy that we made the decision to not only watch the show, but to, like, talk about it here, because we've had time to process it every week and enjoy the journey for what it is and watch it live in real time, like as it's being aired. It's not one that we have to go back, that we can go back and just binge watch it anytime. We were actively keeping up with it, and I think that enhanced the experience of watching it as well. But
you almost feel it would have hurt this show if they released all episodes at once, because you needed that time to process and think and look at what happened before the next. Like, I talk about how I'm going to binge watch it now, but that's because I had that experience going through it first. And now to go back and binge watch, I think it's going to be a different experience than I had watching it the first time. And I still will absolutely love it, but I felt them sticking to the weaker release kind of helped enhance their storytelling of this series.
Sure. And you can catch all 10 episodes of Shogun on Hulu and Disney Plus. It's one, once again, we cannot recommend enough.
Yeah, it's well worth the time and effort to put into the 11-ish hours or so that it'll take to watch all of it. Yep. It's fantastic. Moving into our film review this week. So we decided to go with Boy Kills World, which was such a wild, absurd, over-the-top, insane, crazy, like, everything type of film. Like, it follows Bill Skarsgård's character, Boy, never really get a name to him, that we're kind of in a Hunger Games type of world where this crime boss has control over the city, and every year they have the Culling, and the Culling is killing people that, you know, are opposed or against her rule and trying to show that she has this iron, you know, control over everything, and his family ends up being killed, but he's taken in by this shaman who brutally kind of trains him to be this just weapon of destruction, and we're following his, you know, path of vengeance of trying to get revenge on this woman that's not only holding this city and all these people hostage, you know, they have to live under this rule and deal with the Culling all the time, that also took his family. So, I mean, he has this wild adventure that he goes on, and it was brutally violent, very well filmed, a lot of fun, hysterical, but I mean, I was expecting it to be over the top, but it even surprised me at times with what it did.
Yeah, and it's such a weird, trippy, wild film, right? Because this character, Boy, suffers a terrible tragedy at a young age, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of go through his maturation into adulthood, more or less, but he's still got the mentality and imagination of a young boy, right? So he's, you know, if you know anything about the Skarsgård family, they are very, you know, they have good genes. Let's just put it that way. Those guys are tall, they're athletic, they're ripped, they're bulked. And even Bill Skarsgård surprised me, like, how much he bulked up for this role, too, because, you know, obviously we've seen him as Pennywise the Clown and a few other things. Like, he's starring in The Crow later this year as well, which he got, you know, ripped for that, of course. But, like, it's impressive to see, like, the physical, you know, specimen that he became for this role. And you get the – he's – for context, the character Boy cannot hear and he can't talk. He's a he's deaf and mute, right? Mm-hmm. So you get the circumstances behind at least why he's deaf. Like, so you get some, you know, you get some context behind that. But he's, you know, you start with him going through this training and him becoming this weapon. And since he is deaf and mute, in order to tell the story, he adopts the narration of a voice from his favorite video game when he was a kid. And that's the, one of the last voices he remembers. And it's voiced by H. John Benjamin, who, if you know who H. John Benjamin is, he's the voice of Bob from Bob's Burgers. He's also Archer. He's an incredible voice actor.
One of the best voices out there.
Amazing. Like, when it's his voice, you know it. Like, he's so funny.
Yeah, great comedic timing with this.
The writing in this is so humorous, so hilarious, because he's narrating it as, like, you're seeing things from his perspective, and as he's viewing things, and as he's going, it's so funny. There's so many absurd, over-the-top things happen in this guy's quest for revenge. And it does come with a very interesting plot twist throughout the course of the film, because you do eventually find out who the boy actually is. And, you know, the ramifications from that that lead to this insane fight sequence by the end. And it's full of, it's chock full of wild fights and just humor mixed into it, too. There's some fighting of, you know, potentially serial, like serial type of fighters too, like serial mascots, and just brutal action. But it's not like over the top, incredibly gory either. It's intense, it's gory, but it's
can
not,
be in a couple moments, but
yeah, in a few. But it, the violence is there, and it's. I had a lot of fun with this film. Like I didn't know. Like, it was one of those, if you see it from the previews, you're like, could it be good? Could it not? I had fun watching this.
Yeah, I explained this film to a coworker and friend because she was thinking about checking it out this weekend. And I was like, the best way I could describe it was kind of like Hunger Games meets Kill Bill and a little bit of The Raid and then Kung Fu Hustle. If you don't know, Kung Fu Hustle is over the top dubbed, you know, Japanese action, but done in an American way. Like, it is absurdly over the top. Like, as you said, with H. John Benjamin, like, he is a hysterical guy. I got to give it to Bill to be able to act an entire film without speaking, but having to react to the stuff that, like, H. John Benjamin, I'm sure he or someone was on set doing, you know, the inner monologue the whole time for him. But to, you know, be able to stay in the moment as a character by also listening to someone else say the lines that are supposed to be inside your head and react to it. He did a fantastic job. And, like, yeah, this is one, even if you want to turn your brain off to it, you can. It's got a fun enough story, and it tells, does the job of telling the story really well. Like, it was a blast to see in theaters. We were laughing so much throughout. Even one character, because I don't want to spoil it, there's one character in particular that has very specific lines that are said in a very specific way, and it is absolutely hysterical. Like, we even greeted each other with some of the lines and saying it to each other. Like, it was so out of left field that you didn't expect it to happen, and it's like, okay. And
Golden Toad.
It's a crazy, trippy, over-the-top, and you got Famke Janssen as the main villain. You know, Jean Grey from, you know, our Marvel and X-Men time here. Like, she was great. She had kind of more limited to with it overall. But, like I said, the action sequences were so much fun to watch. Like, some of them were very brutal. But it was a wild, fun trip that I had such enjoyment watching.
Yeah, walking out, we both had some phantom arm and leg pain. We'll leave it at that, just based on one particular scene at the very end that was just insane. But yeah, it's like you said, it's a lot of fun, and the one scene that you're talking about that we were just dying laughing in is, it's obviously with him being deaf and mute, he has to learn how to read lips, and he has issues reading one particular person's lips, and oh man, it doesn't do it justice to talk about, because it's worth a watch for sure. But yeah, like you said, the plot of the film, it's not breaking any new ground. It's an action film, it's a comedy, and it's worth a watch, I would say, because it's, if you enjoy those types of films, you're gonna like this one too. Like, it's not a bad film by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not winning any Oscars. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, it's one to go to theater and have a ton of fun with. Like, and absolutely, we need those at times. We have, I think Shogun gave us so much depth and deepness. It was great to have something that was so absurd, lighthearted, over the top action sequences. It was great to have that kind of release just to go and have fun.
And we did, and it's one that we definitely recommend you checking out. I don't think it's going to be in theaters very long, but when it does come out, if you do get a chance to go see it there, we cannot recommend doing that enough. But definitely one that if you don't make it to the theater to watch, watch when it comes out on streaming, because it's worth 2 hours of your time for sure.
It was a blast.
So yeah, that's Boy Kills World in theaters now and hopefully coming on demand and streaming very soon. Now, we wanted to take this opportunity to thank everybody who entered into our merch giveaway. We thank you all so much for that. Just to help kick off the merch store, thank you to everybody who has already purchased merch from the store. We will continue to put the links to that into every video that we post. You can also go to willbringthepopcorn.com to get the link to the merch. But to kind of kick it off, we did want to give a giveaway opportunity out for somebody to win a free shirt, as well as a 4K copy of Ghostbusters 1 and 2. So thank you. We had close to 150 total entries in total, which is awesome. Thank you all so much for that. And we would like to take this opportunity to announce that the winner of that giveaway is Logan Malakote. So thank you, Logan. We appreciate you. We will be in touch with you very soon. Just be on the lookout for an email from us. We can get your shirt size, and we will get that out to you very soon. So thank you so much for everyone that entered, and congratulations, Logan. That's awesome.
Congratulations again. Yeah, thanks to everyone who entered. Let us know for our next giveaway what you want to see. If there's something in particular with merch, or you know, if we include a movie or do something else, let us know if something that you feel would be fun that you'd love to enter. But yeah, we had a good turnout, and congratulations to Logan. Like, yeah, look out for that email. We'll get all your information, get everything sent out to you, and hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you.
So what's coming up this week? So in theaters this week, we have The Fall Guy. So I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. So me and my wife are going to go see it together. And of course, you're going to see it as well. But it feels like a good date night movie. But all the buzz we've heard around it feels like they're doing a respectable movie to stunt people, of people who just don't get the admiration. There needs to be an Oscar category for stunt work, because they do such incredible things that just go unnoticed for the most part. Like, if a stunt is done really well, you don't even know that other people were involved in, you know, doubling or setting up the everything for it. Like, I'm glad this type of movie's coming out, and it seems like it's paying good respect to him, but it just looks like a ton of fun as well with Ryan Gosling. Just looks like he's having another blast going from Barbie to this. Like, he's just having so much fun on screen. And so we're going to be checking that out this week. You also have the 25th anniversary re-release of Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. That'll be out May 3rd. So you've got for Star Wars weekend the re-release of that. And again, it makes me feel old that it's been 25 years since that's come out, but it's also nice to see now that people are kind of having a little bit more respect for the prequels, because they were loathed and hated when they first came out, and then after the sequels came out, a lot of people were like, hey
maybe not so bad,
the prequels weren't so bad. Like, they had issues, but again, as much as I love Star Wars, the original three had a lot of issues as well. But like, I don't know if I'm going to go to check out Phantom Menace again in theaters, but I'm glad that they're doing it and putting that back out. So that's what you have to look forward in theaters this week. On streaming, we have The Idea of You on Prime Video. Turtles All the Way Down is coming on Max. Both of those will be available May 2nd. So Turtles All the Way Down has a local connection for us, because it was either partially or fully filmed in Cincinnati here. So I'm looking forward to checking that out and pointing out, oh, hey, I know that spot. Everything. And then we have kind of, I guess, the more absurd, weird release of the week is Unfrosted on Netflix on May 3rd. And if you haven't heard anything about this, this is like Jerry Seinfeld is doing the story of Pop-Tarts, of how Pop-Tarts come around. We've already seen like Tony, like Hugh Grant is Tony the Tiger or something in it. Like, it feels like a very weird meta type of film, and I'm looking forward to checking it out and seeing exactly what they did with telling the story of Pop-Tarts.
It's wild, because we're in the last several years now, we're getting some of these very niche like movies mm-hmm. being made. Like there was the film that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck put together of the first Jordan Nike shoe, mm-hmm. very niche like type thing. We also got the Tetris movie, mm-hmm. like about Tetris that was made, and now we're getting one about Pop-Tarts. So what a time.
And we have the GameStop stock sales and stuff. That was another kind of odd movie. So they're going out there like, bring on the original stuff, even if it's weird and quirky and strange. Yeah, keep trying to do this original material.
It's definitely one that I'm going to give it a watch for sure, just to see what's going mm-hmm. on. Because, you know, Pop-Tarts are, you know, an American, at least American, you know, staple of breakfast. You know, that's, mm-hmm. It's something, you know, over the years that, it's gotten hundreds of different like type of flavor stuff made for it, and
they even just took over sponsorship of a college football bowl to where they devoured the Pop-Tart mascot afterwards.
I love that was so funny.
It was so over the top.
Yeah, that's definitely one to keep an eye on for sure. Mm-hmm. Definitely one worth watching. But that'll do it for this week's episode. We'll bring the popcorn again. We can't thank you everyone to those of you that entered into our merch giveaway, who have continued to buy merch as well and supported the show. Thank you for everybody that comments on our videos every week and interacts with us on our social medias and our Discord. Can't thank you enough for that. Coming up next week, we will be giving you our thoughts on episode 8 of X-Men 97. Like we said, it's part one of a 3-part season finale for this, so we're excited to check that out and talk about it. And we will also be reviewing, like we mentioned, the new Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt film Fall Guy that is coming out in theaters this week as well, so we'll give you our thoughts on that as well. And until next time, I'm Josh, he is Brad, and we will see you next week.